Basically, we're going to continue on now talking about proteins, which is the whole what we've been doing. And we started most basically at the very beginning with the amino acids, which again, a reminder, the 20 natural amino acids. You know the base, which is the amino group, the alpha carbon, the carboxylic acid. You got to know all those R groups now, what you stick on that base, the amino acids. We've been through this. Make sure that you understand this little example that comes in the middle of page one having to do with these codons. So you've got a DNA sequence and a messenger RNA sequence, and then you can translate it into a little protein. Again, amino acid activation. Key is uses energy. Here's the tRNAs. We talked about ribosomes. And now we're up to actually getting into the protein synthesis. So the whole thing called translation of messenger RNA into a protein, and remember, the DNA is storing the genetic information, so it has basically all of the rules for putting together the proteins that we need, and it passes them over to the messenger RNA. And then translation of that messenger RNA into an actual protein using the codons requires ribosomes, obviously messenger RNA, transfer RNAs, and lots of different factors, exogenous protein factors, and energy. And we haven't talked about energy yet, we will, but energy primarily for biochemical reactions comes from ATP and GTP. Now, there's three major steps that happen, and they are pretty logical. One is we initiate, we elongate, and then we stop or we terminate. So there's four steps required to initiate this whole translation sequence. The ribosome has to dissociate. We have to form what's called a pre-initiation complex. And we have to form a 4DS complex and an ADS complex. And again, there's pictures of all of these. As you kind of follow this through, you'll see, if you want to look at the picture, what we just said in words. So basically, we're making a number of complexes, and what we end up with is initiation. So we begin translation. So basically what that means is we begin translating the codons into amino acids. Clearly we initiate, so we start with number one. Remember, usually methionine. Most proteins, methionine. Then we need to elongate, and basically that means we add one amino acid at a time to the growing chain, so to the polymer. And this is going on the ADS ribosome, so it's a ribosomal process. And there's three steps that happen with the elongation. The transfer RNA binds, the peptide bond forms, which remember is just an amide bond, but we call it a peptide bond, and then we begin the translocation or reading the codons, the messenger RNA, in sets of three, and translating it into amino acids. Then, how does it know when to stop so it doesn't just make one gigantic protein, is basically when one of the three stop or nonsense codons appear, then it terminates and we end this whole thing, and the protein then is ready to go on to be processed. Again, there's an energy cost to all of this, and the energy cost is again in the form of ATP and GTP, and it costs us to use the tRNA, binding of the tRNA, the translocation, all those things cost energy, activation of amino acids. So it's costing us some high energy phosphate bonds for this process to occur, which again is not all that surprising. So once the protein then, we've terminated, we stop reading codons, we've got to mature the protein, basically get it processed, kind of a UPS kind of thing where they package it, box it, get it ready, and then send it out, secrete it so that it can go off and do what it does. Whether it's an enzyme, it'll go off and catalyze a reaction. If it's a protein that's part of structure, which we'll look at those kind of proteins, structural proteins today, a membrane protein, it'll go off and join the membrane where it belongs. So there's a rate, of course, of protein synthesis. About six peptide bonds, or six of those amide bonds, can be formed per minute, so pretty quick. So it takes about 1 to 2 minutes to synthesize an average size protein. So it gives you an idea of what's going on. The messenger RNAs are usually several thousand nucleotides in length. And so the same messenger RNA can be bound to a lot of different ribosomes at the same time. And that's called a polysome, probably a nomenclature you've heard. So a messenger RNA is bound by a lot of ribosomes. It's a polymer, and it's called a polysome. So what that means is we can get a lot of copies of a protein from a single messenger RNA, so it's very efficient. Not everything has to start from the very beginning. And again, remember, we're using energy to do this whole thing. So what happens when protein synthesis terminates, that methionine ends up being the amino end of the protein, so the free amino group. And of course, the very last amino acid that got added, the last amide bond formed, will then be the carboxy end, or the C-terminus of the peptide. So basically, protein synthesis occurs end to C. So it starts at the amino end with the methionine, and it proceeds to the carboxyl end. There's a little picture where you can kind of see pictorially a little bit what's going on. So there's the nucleus, which of course is storing the genetic information, the DNA. It passes that on through transcription to the messenger RNA. Messenger RNA, we go through the translation, so we've got activation of amino acids, the tRNAs, binding of the ribosomes, and finally we end up with a protein. Notice now the protein goes into the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And so it's now in the ER. And in there, it's basically packaged. There's some processing that goes on. The protein can be changed a little bit, shaped, and it's basically packaged for export out across the membrane. So it's in the processing that it folds and the disulfide bonds form between any cysteine residues that it needs. And there's some other little processes that take place in its processing, kind of getting it into shape so that it can become an active protein. Now some proteins, even after they cross out through the membrane, need even more post-translational modification before becoming fully active, and that can be things like sometimes they need a piece of the protein needs to be taken off, sometimes things have to be phosphorylated, glycosylation, lots of different things happen in processing. Lots of chemical groups are added, taken away, and anyway the protein then gets its shape and all of its needed information on it to make it fully functional. Because when it's made, when it's just gone through translation and we have just kind of the raw protein that's been synthesized to the end to the C-terminus, it's not necessarily an active protein. So it's got to be folded and glycosylated and phosphorylated and cleaved and disulfide bonds formed, etc. And then it becomes an active protein. And that's when it'll go off, of course, and bind substrate if it's an enzyme, catalyze a reaction. We're going to look at membrane proteins. They bind to membranes. And they have lots of functions. They're translocators. Some of them act as receptors. Some of them are pumps. There are proteins that sit on the inside and the outside and cross membranes. Some of our proteins we're going to see are structural. We're going to talk a lot about collagen and elastin and the things that make up our the structural part of our bodies. So all the myriad of functions of proteins, they go off and do what it is that they've been genetically DNA predetermined to do. There are things that can inhibit this process. And there's three antibiotics, streptomycin, erythromycin, and tetracycline, which are all inhibitors of translation. Streptomycin prevents the tRNA from binding, so it blocks our initiation, the beginning. Erythromycin binds to the 50S subunit on the ribosome, so it basically blocks the ribosome. So it blocks translocation. Tetracycline also basically binds to the ribosome, and because it's bound there, then the tRNA can't bind, and that affects or stops translation. There's also a couple of toxins. One is the diphtheria toxin, and the other is ricin. Ricin's something you've heard about. Some terrorist groups have ricin and have used ricin on people. And you can see by its potency that basically one molecule of ricin can kill a cell So it doesn't take a whole lot of ricin to kill a human being or numerous human beings. And the way the poison works, again, is as a translational inhibitor. Diphtheria, of course, is a disease. Very powerful, a few micrograms of diphtheria toxin could kill a human being. So bad things that inhibit translation of proteins, which then, of course, will cause all kinds of problems, because we're going to go on now and see what proteins do. So again, there's lots of material in there that you can read through, suitable really for genetic study. And then focus on the objectives. Why did I do that? Ooh, I didn't want a Microsoft Word. Gosh, this computer is so slow. Proteins, globular membrane, fibrous, and structural. We'll see fibrous and structural are pretty much the same type of proteins. So starting out with globular proteins, that is a type of protein that is particularly important because enzymes are globular proteins. And we're going to end up talking a lot about globular proteins. They tend to be very soluble, freely soluble proteins, so they're very charged. They have lots of hydrophilic residues on their surface. They have a core area where all the hydrophobic residues hide, kind of excluding water. Again, enzymes are globular. Besides the hydrophobic effect, which remember is the primary way that proteins maintain their tertiary structure, is via the hydrophobic effect, meaning just like attracts like. Hydrophilic things tend to gather towards the outside, be near water, hydrophobic things towards the center. The other two ways that proteins, particular globular proteins, maintain tertiary structure is they form salt bridges. And notice that's really an ionic bond between an acid and a base. And they form disulfide bonds or disulfide bridges. And notice that is a bridge between those two active sulfur groups in cysteine residues. And disulfide bridges form very, very easily. Remember, those sulfurs are highly reactive, lots of electron density there. And if they get anywhere near each other, they easily form disulfide bridges. The feature that globular proteins share that's important is they have a site that we call the active site where they can bind a small molecule or a substrate. So we call that small molecule a substrate. So all globular proteins have some sort of site where they can bind a small molecule or substrate. So introduction to enzymes, which we're going to come back and see much of immediately after the quiz. Again, an enzyme is a biological catalyst, so it converts some kind of reactant or substrate to product. It's a globular protein. An enzyme often requires an extra or supplementary group for it to be active. And the supplementary group that it requires is called a cofactor. So enzymes, most of them require cofactors to be fully active. And there's two types of cofactors, organic and inorganic. Inorganic is the simplest. They tend to be metals like iron, copper, and magnesium. So the enzyme requires iron, copper, and magnesium to be fully active. Or they can be organic, and there's two types of organic cofactors. One is a coenzyme, which comes and goes. It's easily removed. It's usually a vitamin. We're going to see lots of vitamins that act as coenzymes or organic cofactors. And the other type of organic cofactor is called a prosthetic group. And a prosthetic group is something that's covalently attached to the enzyme and cannot come and go like a coenzyme can. So it's covalently attached. And the big example of that we're going to see is the heme group in hemoglobin and myoglobin, the heme group. Many globular proteins are glycoproteins. And glycoproteins are basically globular proteins that are in circulation that have been modified by putting a sugar on them. So glycosylation is attachment of a sugar unit to a protein, making a glycoprotein. What this does is you can look at the sugar unit, and you remember the sugar unit's got lots of hydroxyl groups on it, so it increases greatly the hydrophilicity, solubility of the protein. It also enhances biological activity of the protein, and the way it does that is, you remember we have a variety of different sugars. There's lots and lots of sugars in the body, and each of those sugars has lots of hydroxyl groups on it, and it can basically attach to the protein with any of those hydroxyl groups. So we've got lots of sugars, lots of hydroxyl groups. So the possibilities of different sugar modifications are pretty much exponential. And what that means is that glycoproteins, these proteins with sugars attached, have what we call very high information content. And information content is important because it is through these sugars that are attached to these proteins that cells communicate with each other and that they recognize each other. So they recognize something as being foreign or as being self, which has to do with your immune system, and also the way they communicate with each other. So glycosylation is a very important part of making a protein fully functional or modifying a protein once it is synthesized. And again, it's putting a sugar group on it. There's two types of glycosylation. The enzymatic type is the easiest because it's very specific. It's enzyme directed, so there's a specific enzyme telling the sugar what protein to go to. Generally involves some kind of anhydride formation, enzymatic glycosylation. The other type of glycosylation is not at all specific. There's no enzyme involved. It's called non-enzymatic glycosylation. And it involves formation of a shift base. And hopefully you've heard of a shift base in organic chemistry. And basically, a shift base, you can see, is when the sugar, the aldehyde group, for instance, of glucose, attaches itself to the amino group on the protein. That could be one of the side chain groups for, say, lysine that's sticking off the protein. And the aldehyde group reacts with the amino group, and you get a shift base. You'll notice that is a reversible reaction, shift base formation. And again, the key about non-enzymatic glycosylation is it's not specific, so it can pretty much go on pretty much all over the place. And we're going to see more about non-enzymatic glycosylation in a little clinical correlate. The other type of protein, moving on from globular, so globular are important because enzymes are globular. Globular proteins can bind some sort of substrate at a site we call the active site. They can also be glycosylated, important again for information content, which allows cells to communicate with each other and recognize each other. Another type of protein that's really important then is a membrane protein. We're going to see these again in some detail when we talk about membranes. For now, you can see a picture of a variety of different membrane proteins. Many of the membrane proteins have a globular domain on them, so part of them is globular in nature, meaning it can bind a substrate. Membrane proteins, of course, are associated or anchored somehow to a membrane. That's why we call them membrane proteins. And they fall into three basic categories. Membrane proteins can be receptors, so that would be a membrane protein that's stuck in, through, or sitting on a membrane, which has a globular piece to it where it can bind something. It can act as a receptor for things like hormones. They can be transporters, so they can span the membrane. You can see some examples up there of some of those white blobs are going all the way through the membrane, so they can transport things in and out. And some of the proteins, this is particularly the ones that sit on the outside, and they're almost always glycoproteins, are responsible for cell-cell recognition and communication. And those are the proteins you see sitting on the outside of the membrane, and they're glyco, i.e. they have carbohydrates attached to them. So these little sticks are the carbohydrate chains and sugars attached to the protein. And remember, that gives it very high information content and allows cell-cell communication and recognition. So we're going to come back and see these. Again, you can see some of them span, and that allows transport of molecules in and out. Some of them sit on the inside, some on the outside. And we're going to come back and look in detail at these membrane proteins when we talk about membranes on Monday. The receptors then would have a piece sitting on the outside that's globular in nature. Transporter goes through. Cell-cell recognition is glycosylated, has those sugars sitting off of it. And when we talk about membranes on Monday, we'll look at blood typing, how we can use some of those carbohydrates, particularly the enzymes, the direct enzyme-specific glycosylation, to figure out what blood types people are. That's the ABO system of blood typing. So you will see that. Again, membranes, which we're going to focus on Monday, remember when we talk about them that they have a place, and that is that they are basically the walls of cells, both the compartments inside cells and cells themselves.